Lots of people can build and sell one business. And when you've done that, you want to go and do the second one because you want to prove that you weren't lucky. Some people can do it twice. I've done it six times and I'm looking for the next six. No, ambition is too high. And even at 19, you want to run the biggest travel company in the world. Well, go and do it.
The Steve Isali study is about having thoughtful conversations. My next podcast guest was a former CEO of Thomas Cook, a man called Terry Fisher. Very interesting guy, very well-rounded, very successful. I believe if you're a young, inspiring entrepreneur, you're going to get a lot of value from this. Be happy, never content, and make sure you're subscribing. Right, welcome back to the podcast, the Steve Isali study. We have a very exciting guest in front of me today, Mr. Terry Fisher. Thank you very much for coming onto the podcast and also coming to Woodbury House Art Gallery for the first time. Because, I mean, it's going to sound like a bit of a plug, but because you've walked into the gallery before you came down to the podcast studio, what did you think of the gallery? What do you think of the artwork up on the wall, Terry? Being an art collector yourself.
Yeah, so I am. I do collect contemporary art, and a lot of the stuff that you've got from the artists that you work with are things that I would choose to collect. So I was particularly excited to come in here. I'd heard a lot about it before. I've never been. Very remiss of me, I'm sorry. But now I know where you are and what you've got, I'm sure I'll be in more often. But yeah, the art's really cool. The gallery's great. The space is fantastic.
Thank you. I really want to hear this story that you just shared with me before we kicked off about an artist called Retna. And the only reason why I want to speak about it is quite relevant because we represent a guy called Defa who was on the opposing gang in LA. Both got very, very similar styles. Both are pioneers and iconic. I've never met Retna, but I've heard a lot of stories and I heard he can be slightly psychopathic and a bit schizophrenic and a bit nutty. And then also, you know, you're friend with a guy called Harlan Miller. So if you don't mind sharing some of that story again, that would be great, Terry.
Yeah, so Harlan and I have been friends for a long time. We're both massive Leeds United fans. We go to the games together. I've known Harlan a long time and I'm a big fan of his work and a big collector. I was living in LA at the time and Harlan was having a show in LA. And it was kind of, because it was LA, there's a lot of celebrities there. It was quite a high profile celebrity driven event. And Retna was invited, but didn't show up for the dinner at 7. So everyone assumed, I guess, that he wasn't coming. And about 10 o'clock in the evening, when the whole event was drawing to a close, Retna arrived. Very noisy, very obvious arrival. Everybody knew Retna was in the building. And by that time, because Harlan was and is incredibly popular, most of the show was sold out. So Retna came in and loudly in front of everybody just interrupted, took over the whole room. I don't know if you've met him, but he's a huge character. He's a huge guy. And he took over the whole space and he just went, "Which one's Harlan? Which one's Harlan?" And Harlan kind of sheepishly at the back is going like, "Oh, that'll be me." And he goes, "I love you, Harlan. I fucking love you. Your work's amazing. I think you're fantastic. I want to buy out the whole show. I want to buy everything. Everything you can see, I want to buy it all." And Harlan's like, "It's really nice to meet you too. And I'm a big fan of your work also. You're a very talented artist. Thanks for coming. But you need to talk to the guy at White Cube over here because I think most of the show, if not all of the show, is sold out." No, you don't understand. I love you. I want to buy the show." So Alan said, "Well, this is George. He works for White Cube. You need to talk to George and George will tell you what's available." So Retna goes to George and George says, "Look, I'm really sorry, Mr. Retna. It's lovely to meet you. I'm very honored to meet your acquaintance. I love your work. I think you're a fabulous artist. But unfortunately, the whole show is sold out." At that point, Retna just smacks George right on the nose and obliterates his face. There's blood everywhere. Everybody's like shocked at what the hell just happened. And the guy's on the floor clutching his nose. There's blood everywhere. The paramedics are called and LAPD are called. And the next thing you know is that Retna is being handcuffed behind his back, led out by LAPD and still screaming at the top of his voice, "I fucking love you, Harlan. I want to buy out the whole show." And having lived in LA for quite some time, I see Retna's work everywhere. And I am a collector. I have pieces of his work myself. But I was never experienced the behavior that I saw that night. And I'd heard his reputation. I'd heard he was capable of that. But I actually witnessed it firsthand. And it was quite shocking, to be honest.
So before your successes in business, investments, etc. Were you interested, were you a collector of art before, or did that come after when you got some money in your pocket?
Yeah, so I kind of retired. I sold a business called Going Places when I was about 31, and I retired to Marbella. And I obviously had a few quid in my pocket, and I bought a villa, and I got introduced to a guy called Fabian Frins, who owned an art gallery in the Marbella Club Hotel. And Fabian and I became friends, and Fabian introduced me to art. And that was kind of my sort of learning curve. And we went together about 20 years ago, Fabian and I, to China, to Beijing. And we bought a lot of Chinese contemporary art at a time when it wasn't particularly collectible, because he had a vision that it was going to massively increase in value. And he was absolutely right. We went and bought stuff from artist studios that we were paying, you know, hundreds of dollars for. And a few years later, we're selling for tens of thousands of dollars. Mm. And I guess, you know, meeting Fabian, having some spare time, going to China, having that experience, and making money from it as well, it kind of got me hooked on contemporary art. And for quite some time, I only bought things through Fabian. And as I said, I moved to LA. I met another art dealer in LA, an English guy in LA. Started buying things from him, and it sort of just grew from there, really.
When I meet a collector, someone that buys art for the first time, I'm always quite interested to get under the bonnet, into your mind, trying to work out some of the reasons why you purchase art. Now, quite naturally, some people buy art to speculate, to make money as an investment. Some people buy it because it looks good in their home or office. Some people might buy it because it complements what they've already got. And some people buy it because, well, they like the backstory, they like the narrative, they like the culture behind it. What kind of resonates with you when you purchase art?
So when I first bought art, I would go to Fabian and I would say, look, what have you got that's got orange in it? And he'd be like, what? I'm like, what have you got that's got orange in it? Because I'm redoing my apartment and I need something with orange on the walls. And he'd be like, I can't talk to you. I'm a serious art dealer. I'm not going to sell you something just because it's orange. So my initial introduction really was because I wanted it to look good on the wall and match the curtains and the cushions. But very quickly I learned that that was not a sensible rationale for buying art. And I just started buying things that I liked. And I think I had a reasonably good eye. I bought things that I liked. I bought things that I thought would look good on my walls. And then over the years, people would come into my apartment and compliment me on the art and say, I really like that piece. Where did you get that from? I like this piece. Where did you get that from? And I started helping friends to buy art. So then I started buying and selling a little bit myself and just getting more and more and more involved in it. I was friends with Harland. I'd source things from Harland and let friends and sell on to friends or buy stuff from White Cube or whatever it was. And I was just enjoying being part of the art world. I really found it quite fascinating. And to this day, I love it. I'm still buying, changing. You know, we talked earlier about I've got a retina piece, you've got a retina piece, yours is better than mine, I want yours. You can, you know, it's just a bug. I think you get into art and it just becomes a passion, really.
Definitely. There's the bug, people get addicted, the hook. But what I love about the art market is a bit of a melting pot. You can have a billionaire over here or a regular person walking in off the street and they're in the same room, appreciating the same art and having a good, decent conversation. It brings everybody together. And as corny, as cliche, and as wanky as that may sound, there is, bar music and a few other things, there isn't many sectors out there where you have all different types of people from all different walks of life, all different ages, races, etc., being in one room talking about the artist or this particular body of work. And I think that's a very special thing.
I think that's true.
Definitely. I have to give a special mention to our sponsors. iSecure Vehicles. They are a brilliant company, a family-run business, and they specialize in vehicle safety and security throughout the UK. I know this company very well, and I also know the people behind the brand. If you've been following me on my podcast journey and on social media, you will know that I love cars and so does my network. This is why I'm very, very excited to be working with iSecure Vehicles, and this is why we have chosen them to be our sponsors for the Stephen Sully Study podcast. Their team are professionals, experts, and they're efficient. Once a product is installed on your car, your vehicles, you will have the peace of mind that your asset is protected. Trust me, do not wait until it's too late. Get protection now. For more information about their products, including dash cameras, undetected immobilizers, and also car tracking systems, head over to isecure-vehicles.co.uk. And remember to mention the Stephen Sully Study podcast sent you. So, before you got into buying art, I'm going to actually ask you this question, and it's going to lead me on to what I want to talk to you about. Terry, what is your what's your definition of being successful?
My definition? I think being able to live the life that you want to live. I think being successful gives you new opportunities, more opportunities. It gives you time. It gives you the ability to buy things that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to buy. And it gives you an opportunity to live the lifestyle that many people would aspire to but are not able to achieve. So I think for me, it's about lifestyle choices. I worked really, really hard from being 18 to being 40, so that from 40 onwards, I could not work hard and enjoy what I'd made over those years. So I think, you know, I'm still working hard now because I keep retiring, promising myself I'm going to slow down, and then going back to it again and doing something else. I literally had a call as I was coming in here, you saw I was on the phone, some guys who want to make me apparently an offer I can't refuse, but I need to be in Dubai by tomorrow evening. And at the minute, I haven't decided whether I'm going or not yet, but you know, I'm trying to slow down, have a nice weekend at home with the kids, and I'm probably going to end up on a plane to Dubai tomorrow afternoon. So I think you know, you get the bug. It's like buying and collecting art. You get the bug. I get the bug of being successful in business, helping people, turning things around, creating wealth for other people is something that, you know, that sounds a little bit of a cliche, a bit wankish, as you said earlier, but I actually enjoy helping other people to achieve what they're looking to achieve as well, because, you know, I've been fairly fortunate over my life, and I'm now trying to help others get there as well.
Because, we all have read the books or listened to the podcasts or watched interviews where people talk about success, and 9 times out of 10 is connected to money. And I do believe that part of being overall successful, money, being financially stable is definitely a key opponent. And after all, when you get into business, yes, you want to build a good brand. Yes, you want to have good customers and good service, good system, good product. But ultimately, a business cannot flourish unless it's profitable. And so making money's got to be a part of that. But the reason why I ask you the question is because as I've grown older, I'm 37, almost approaching 38 in the next couple of months. Next month, actually. Fucking hell, it's gone quickly. You know what? It's like the experiences you go through. You know, and it doesn't always have to be about money. And then I also look at someone's kind of, again, this is a wanky statement, like the energy of someone, like just the energy that they've got. And you can tell when someone's successful because no matter how much money you've got in your bank, no matter how many places you've been to, no matter how many board meetings you sat on or how many startup investments or how many people you've helped, has that person still got the energy for life? And that's what struck me when you walked through the door earlier.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you vibrate at a different level, for sure. I think that's important. Just going back to something you said earlier, though, about for business to be successful, it has to be making money before you can sell it. We sold, if you look at a business like Facebook, it's not making any money. We sold Voicy to Snapchat a couple of years ago, and Voicy was hemorrhaging money. I was sick to death of bootstrapping it. I couldn't see an end in sight. And then lockdown came, and we went from 1 million users a month to 1 million users a day, and had Snapchat, Spotify, and Facebook all trying to buy it. And that never made any money. So I think sometimes you can build a business and build massive users, for example, on an app. You build millions and millions of users, and that in itself has a value, even though the business may not be making any money. And we were very fortunate with that, in that we got it away to Snapchat during lockdown. And I could see, you know, part of being a good entrepreneur is having good vision, right? And I could see that we built a business that had gone absolutely ballistic during lockdown. But I also knew that lockdown wasn't going to last forever. And it was, you know, as quickly as it could rise during lockdown, it could fall after lockdown. So actually selling it when we did, we sold it right at the very top of the market, and we were very opportunistic.
2020?
Yeah. But it wasn't making any money. And whether it ever would have made any money under our guidance or not, I really don't know. But it's a great example of building something and building huge volume around it, and it's still having a value even though it's not profitable.
I had a little stint in that world myself. I was a founder of a wellness app called Mimboso, Mind, Body and Soul. And it was all about peak performance on your mind, your body, training, competing, lifting, going to the gym. And soul, our spin on soul was nutrition. So feeding your soul with the right foods, you know, meal prepping, etc. And I totally resonate with that. You know, didn't make any single money. Unfortunately, it fell by the wayside. There was a couple of things that didn't really go in our favor. But I understand, you know, you're building a community, you're building a culture, you're building a brand. And in tech, it's almost like throwing loads and loads and loads of money at it. And then eventually, hopefully, you either sell, float, or some sort of monetization element comes into the app. And that's how it's sustainable. So I totally resonate with what you're saying now.
I learned a great lesson in Voicy about, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, but you never stop learning, and you never stop appreciating other, even more successful entrepreneurs. And we got a fantastic offer from Facebook to sell Voicy, and the boys who developed the app didn't want to work for Facebook. They'd heard bad things about Facebook. They didn't want to work for Facebook. We had a great offer from Daniel Ek at Spotify, but what really captured it was the lowest of the three offers came from Evan Spiegel at Snapchat. But what Evan Spiegel did really, really cleverly was he rang each of the four founders personally and said, "Hey, it's Evan Spiegel from Snapchat. I love what you've done with Voicy. I'd love you to come and be part of the Snapchat family. I'd love you to move to Santa Monica. I'd love to put your kids in school. I'd love to put your wife in yoga pants." And, you know, sold them the dream, sold them the vision. By the time he'd finished, and then 10 minutes to each and 40 minutes of his life, they're all beating their chest going, "Evan Spiegel loves us. We only want to sell to him." He was the lowest of the three bids, but we had no choice but to sell to him because he'd done such a genius job. And I'm sat there like clapping my hands going, "You're smart, well done." You know, it was a lesson. I was like, yeah, you took 40 minutes of your time. You probably took, you know, millions of dollars off the value of the business, but you got the guys on side and they all want to work for you.
Well, see, I was saying, right, people don't remember what you say. They remember how you made them feel. So if you can make someone feel good and feel like you're a trusted authority and someone that is going to guide them every step of the way and get them to where they need to be, that's all that counts. Can I ask, are you open about figures? Because I know this company went from a piece of paper idea to 18 months sending over to Snapchat. How much did you sell for?
It was in excess of $100 million.
How much of the company did you own?
Oh, unfortunately, very little. So I came in as an angel investor right at the very beginning. I brought a co-investor in with me that I do quite a lot of investment with. He took twice as much of the equity as I did. Not because he was smarter than me, but because he was probably financially better than me at that time, because I tend to spread myself far too thinly and do so many different things. And then when great opportunities come along, I'm sort of scratching around going, "Where am I going to find that money from?" And Jason took a little bit more of the equity than I did. But essentially, the four founders controlled most of the business. I ended up with about 5%. It was a very nice return. We got 60 times return on our money in 18 months. And one cautionary tale in that, and you know, we've all got them, but I've got a really close friend of mine in Leeds that I still see regularly every time I'm in Leeds. And I got so sick of bootstrapping Voicy towards the end that I just said to Naz, "Naz, do me a favor." I said, "Just stick 50 grand in, right? So that I don't have to pay it this month. I'm not paying the wages. I'm not paying the development costs. Just stick 50 grand in." And he's like, "Oh, I'm not sure. And I'm like, "Naz, it's gonna fly. This is going to fly. I'm telling you, it's going to work." And he's like, "Oh, I'm not sure." And literally 6 months later, that 50 grand would have been worth 3 million. He didn't do it, and he regrets it to this day. But, you know.
Hindsight, eh?
Yeah, hindsight indeed.
The other thing that, you know, listening to your other interviews and stuff and doing a bit of research is how well-travelled you are. And me and my missus, my wife, We speak about this quite a lot because there was years ago there was talks of us maybe going to the Dubai or doing something different and etc. Now, thankfully, we never done that and we got a really good business and things are going really, really great. But we always say, are you a success, no matter how much money you got in the bank, if you're born in one place, you work in one place, you retire in one place, and then you die in that same very place, even if you've got £1 billion to your name, are you a success? I don't know if you are. Maybe in some people's eyes, but I don't think you are. With you, you've gone from Leeds to California to Marbella, probably the other way around, to Preston. Would you say Preston's more tropical than California?
I would say not. I would say that it depends how you define success. So I've been married twice and got two sets of kids.
Okay.
And my oldest daughter has got a successful business. She's successful in her own right. She's got a chain of Mexican restaurants. But she's very little knowledge or very little experience outside of living in West Yorkshire. So she's in Halifax, she's in Huddersfield, she's in Bradford, but she's not seen the world. I've got two younger kids who have been all over the world. My son now says he wants to go and live in Dubai. My daughter's living in London. They're very much more worldly experienced, not yet as successful, but going to be and definitely stepping in the right direction. I look back at times and I think my older daughter, Danielle, has missed out massively by not seeing the world, by not living in different places, by not traveling, by not having those opportunities that I've had and that she could have had, but she chose not to. And I'm determined that my next two kids will not just live in Leeds, born in Leeds, die in Leeds. And you know, that for me is really, really important. But going to your point about California, I've lived in California twice. I love California and I lived there twice. And the first time I lived there, I went for a year to help a friend open an office for a new business that he was launching. And whilst I was living there, I decided I loved the place and I wanted to stay. And that was about 3 months later, I got a call from an ex-business partner of mine who had a travel business based in Preston. And he called me up and said, look, I've had a tragedy, personal tragedy in my life. I don't want to be involved in the business anymore. I want to move out of the country. I need someone I can trust to build this business and sell this business for me. And you're it. And I'm like, Ken, I'm living in Laguna Beach. Like, why do I want to come back to Preston? And he's like, well, come and see me. Come and have a chat. And let's see if we can figure something out. So I put the phone on. My wife said, what was that? I said, it was Ken. I said, I think he wants to offer me a job. She said, do you want a job? I said, not really. She said, do you want to move back to Preston? I said, not really, but I've worked with the guy a long time. I think I owe it to him to go and hear him out. So I got on a plane to Preston and I went to meet him and I sat down on the boardroom table and it was just like something out of a movie. He said, I want you to come and run this business. And I said, I don't want to. Preston's a shithole. Laguna Beach is the nicest place in the world. Sorry for people that live in Preston. No offense. Laguna Beach is the nicest place in the world. I'm not coming back to Preston. And he literally gave me a pen and a piece of paper. And he said, write down what it's going to take for you to take this job.
The money?
Yeah.
How much was that?
And I wrote down to him what I wanted to do the job. And he just read the piece of paper, shook my hand. And 2 weeks later, we're moving back to Preston.
Can I know the figure?
It was a percentage. It was based on an exit deal on the business.
Okay.
But potentially could have made me tens of millions of pounds. And I say potentially because we achieved all the things that we set out to achieve with that business. We made it profitable and we sold it for a lot of money. But unfortunately, a great life lesson for me was that because he was a friend and because we worked together in the past, we had nothing down in writing. Everything was on a handshake. And when it came to it, he decided he wasn't going to pay. Achieved everything I set out to achieve and made him a fortune and gave up 3 years of my life in California to move back to Preston to not get paid at the end of the deal.
So do you believe in don't mix business and friendship?
I do, very strongly. And if you are going to mix it, then get somebody from the outside to draw up the contract and talk to you both individually to get something down on paper so that you're not falling out with your friend. You've got a third party who's mediating And if you can come up with an agreement that suits everyone, great, go ahead. But if you can't, keep your friend.
Yeah. When we talk about CEOs, directors, owners, large shareholders, stereotypically there's an image in someone's head, right? So, you know, the way they look, etc. The LA vibe, I mean, I'm looking at you, got tattoos down two sleeves, got long hair. And I'm surprised, actually. You see, you've had all these businesses, lots of challenges. You've got two sets of kids with two different marriages, but you've not only got no grey hair, but you've actually got a full set of hair, hair on your head, and it's reaching almost your shoulders. Which doesn't strike me that you have too much stress in your life. Is that look from your LA days?
So when I was before I moved to LA the second time. I was CEO of Thomas Cook, and I was very corporate. I was much more overweight than I am now. I had very short hair, no beard, no tattoos, very corporate. And I realized I'd been very successful. I'd built and sold businesses with that look and with that image and being like that. But I moved to LA, and a girl in LA changed my life, to be fair. This is down to the girl that I lived with while I was in LA. She got hold of me and completely changed my life. Yeah, I'd been successful. Yes, I had some money in the bank, but I had no style. I had no real sort of look. And she set about creating what you see today because it was the look and feel that she felt I needed. And unfortunately, the relationship didn't last. But I'm eternally grateful to her, and still friends with her to this day, but eternally grateful to her for the look and the image, because this is me. You know, I feel very comfortable in my skin.
Yeah.
Some people judge you because you've got tattoos, and I was one of those people. I used to judge everyone that had tattoos. But now I'm very comfortable with two sleeves and long hair and jewelry. And yeah, if, you know, I'm kind of like, look, take it or leave it. If you don't want to hire me, you don't want to employ me because you think that I don't look corporate enough or I'm not serious enough because I've got tats, then you're loss.
Well, you look like the modern day billionaire, because when you go to Silicon Valley, or certainly see a lot of these tech billionaires now, they're not the people in the suits. They're not the people that have got grey hair or, you know, went to a certain, I don't know, part, you know, certain university. These are proper, like, you know, young, edgy, you know, kind of cool people that are out there doing their thing. I've got a tattoo myself, so I'm very much on that wave. But when I looked to you and I knew that you lived in LA, I was like, yeah,
you've really gone for that. And people say that to me now. You know, people do say that to me now. They can tell you lived in LA.
Yeah,
you've got the LA vibe.
Yeah, it suits you,
which is great.
Yeah. So, becoming CEO of Thomas Cook, how the hell did that happen?
Well, it started when I was 19 and I opened my first travel agency. So I just scrolling back from that, I decided at a very young age that I wanted to work in travel. When I was 12 or 13 years old, my parents took me on a package holiday to Mallorca. And we're going back 40 years, and travel was not like it is today, 40 years ago. So in order to, as part of the sort of trip to Mallorca, the teacher in my class at school made me stand up in front of the whole class. And she said, Terry's going on an aeroplane to Spain. And everybody's like, whoa. And he's going to come back and he's going to tell us all about it. So I go on a trip to Spain. I go to Mallorca, I come back. And I'm stood in front of the class. I'm only a 13, 14-year-old kid. And I could see how the girls were looking at me. And I thought, this is cool. Because all the girls are looking at me like, he's a cool guy because he's been on an aeroplane and he's been to Spain and he's talking all about it. So even at an early age, I enjoyed an audience and standing up in front of people. But I saw how they looked at me, and I thought, if that's how girls are going to look at me, I want to work in travel. I want to travel some more because this is going to be great as I get older. So I left school, unfortunately, with very few qualifications. I rebelled. My father was a teacher, and I would go one of either two ways. I would either be incredibly studious or incredibly non-studious, whatever the opposite is. And I took the latter. I rebelled. I didn't want to work at school. My dad was trying to drill it into me every night at home, and I just didn't want it. Wasn't interested. So I left school, unfortunately, with not a lot of qualifications. And I joined a travel and tourism course at college. And I lied about the qualifications that I had to get on the course because I wanted to work in travel. And very quickly, into the first year, they found out that I'd lied about my qualifications, and they came to me and said, "Look, you're not qualified for this course. You're not cut out for a career in the travel industry. Go and find something else to do with your life." So I was unceremoniously kicked out of college, and my dad said to me, "Right, what are you going to do now, smart ass?" You know, sort of taking the moral high ground like they do. And I got a job in a travel agency as a junior, stamping brochures and making the coffee, because I was determined to work in the travel business. And everyone said to me, you know, what's your ambition? Why do you want to work in travel? And I said, well, the biggest travel company in the world right now is a company called Thomas Cook, and one day I'm going to be CEO of Thomas Cook. And everybody laughed at me, and they said, like, you're an 18-year-old kid, and that's your ambition. I'm like, yeah, that's what we're going to do. And I then set about building my own travel agency chain. I started when I was 19. I opened one shop. There was just me working in the shop. I had no staff. If I wanted to go for a wee, I had to put a sign on the door saying back in 10 minutes. And I grew that from one shop to 132 shops in 8 years. And we became the largest independent travel chain in the country within 8 years. I found a niche. I exploited the niche, which is what you've got to do if you're going to build a business. You've got to have a point of difference between you and your competitors. And I very quickly established that at 19. I didn't know I was doing that, but I realize now that that's what I did. I established a niche, I established a point of difference, and we grew it rapidly. And I sold that business, which is a precursor to me moving to Marbella. I sold that business when I was about 30, 31. And I sold to a company called Air Tours. And at the time, Air Tours owned a chain in the UK called Going Places. And Going Places had 800 shops. And the guy who bought my business, who owned Air Tours, said to me, look, I want to put you on the board of Going Places because I think I'd like to learn how a big company's run. Your company's now integrated within ours. You've got 132, they've got 800. Go and sit on their board and go and learn. And when you work for yourself and you're growing a business, it's very hard to measure your success because you don't know. You know you're doing well in your own business, but you don't know how that correlates to the rest of the industry. So I would read the trade press and I would see these people on the board of Going Places with 800 shops, and I would think, these guys must be absolute geniuses. You know, I've got 100 shops, they've got 800, they must be 8 times better than me. Goes, stands to reason, right? So I go and I join the board and I sit on the board, and I have to tell you, I am completely underwhelmed. Right? These guys do not know what they're talking about. And as far as I'm concerned, they couldn't run a bath. They've no clue. And the owner of the business came to me after two or three board meetings and said, what do you think? And I said, this is a shit show. These guys don't know what they're doing. They're never going to deliver what you want. They're never going to achieve what you want. And he said, well, what do I need to do? And I said, well, you need to sack the entire board. You need to put me in charge. You need to let me bring my team in. We'll amalgamate the two brands together. We'll call them all Going Places. We'll have 930 shops. We'll be the biggest travel retailer in the country. And it'll be dynamic, and I'll deliver for you everything that you want. And he believed me, and he trusted me, and he did exactly that. And we delivered for him, and we did build the largest travel chain in the UK. And in terms of retail size, we were the number one. We were bigger than Thomas Cook. So I kind of achieved not the ambition that I set out to achieve, because I named Thomas Cook specifically, but I was at 31, 32 running a brand called Going Places, which was the biggest travel retailer in the country. It was still an unfulfilled ambition, though. Thomas Cook was still nagging in the back of my mind. It was still an unfulfilled desire. And when I sold my shares in Going Places, I moved to Marbella and then subsequently to California. But always had this dream still raging in my head to be CEO of Thomas Cook. And so when the guy from Preston called me and said, I want you to come and run my business, and I went back to Preston, I identified very quickly, and this is something I talk about a lot, I identified the exit for the business. He wanted to sell it. He had a timescale of 3 years. And one of the things you've got to do when you're building any business, I believe, is know where your exit is and build an exit strategy from day one. And my exit strategy was to sell that business to Thomas Cook. And the reason for that was because I identified very quickly that we had product in our business that they had gaps in theirs. So what I did over the next 3 years, I exploited Thomas Cook's gaps in their product portfolio and built them into gold medal. So we became the largest tour operator to Dubai. We became the largest tour operator to Las Vegas. We became the largest luxury tour operator with a brand called Pure Luxury. So I knew that everything I did, and I questioned it with my board every time we made a strategic decision, was, does this fit our exit strategy? And our exit strategy was always, we're going to sell this to Thomas Cook. And so that was how we built the business. We turned around the business, and his ambition was to sell the business for £50 million. When I joined on day one, it was valued at £15 million. So we had a long way to go. But in 3 years, we turned that business around so successfully that 3 years later, we got an offer at £72 million. And it was a German company who wanted to buy the business. And Ken was really, really excited and really keen to sell. You've done a great job. I wanted 50, you've got me 72. And I'm like, yeah, but Thomas Cook's haven't come into the bidding yet. And he's like, what do you mean? I said, well, I've built this business for Thomas Cook, and they know I have, and I know I have, and they know we're up for sale, but they've not come to the table. So I need a few more days to get them to the table, because I think they're the buyer for this business. And he said to me, do not fuck this up. There's £72 million on the table. It's more than I could have ever imagined. He said, I'll give you over the weekend. He said, but if we've not got an offer from Thomas Cook by Tuesday, we're taking the £72 million. So I said, yeah, you got a deal. I left that meeting. I went across the office. I shut myself in a private room, and I rang the CEO of Thomas Cook, and I said, Manny, I said, why are you not? You know I'm for sale. You know it fits your product portfolio. You're acquisitive right now. You've got the money. Why are you not at the table? And he said, well, we think that you've done such a fantastic job, you and your team, that once you get paid out, you're going to leave. We're going to spend a lot of money buying a business. It's not going to get integrated into Thomas Cook's properly. We're not going to have the management team that ran it. You know, what are we buying? And I said, well, what you don't know is that my lifelong ambition is to have your job. I said, so if you can guarantee that you will offer me and my team positions within Thomas Cook's and me a seat on the board of Thomas Cook, then we'll all sign long-term service agreements. You can buy the business. We'll integrate it into Thomas Cook, and it'll be the best acquisition you've ever made. He said, what's the offer on the table? I said, £85 million. He said, leave it with me. He thought about it over the weekend. He rang me back on the Tuesday. He said, look, if you'll do all the things that you said you would do, we'll give you £86 million for the business. So in that one phone call, I made the owner £14 million, because the offer on the table was 72, and I sold it to Thomas Cook for 86.
And this is the guy that didn't give you any money.
So we sold the business to Thomas Cook for 86 million. It was 36 million more than he was expecting. And my deal, I'll be honest with you, was 50% of anything over 50 million. So 18 of that 36 was due to me. And he turned around and didn't pay me. And to this day, it's something, it's a life lesson. It's a massive life lesson. I think about it every day, because £18 million in those days was a lot of money.
£18 million in today's world is a lot of money. Even £1 million,
indeed.
Even £500,000.
I'm being very facetious when I say that, but it's the only way I can deal with the trauma.
Guys, I wanted to hop on here to once again thank the sponsors of this week's podcast, iSecure Vehicles. When we were searching around for sponsors for the channel, we honestly wanted to get a brand, a company that would give massive amount of value to our audience, and that is definitely iSecure Vehicles. They have a wide range of products which are designed to keep your vehicle, your asset, safe and secure. Some of those products are dash cameras, undetected immobilizers, and car tracking systems. Head over to iSecure to look at their products and make sure you say that the Stephen Sully Study podcast sent you there. So I do want to get to the most important parts, which is the business, the mindset, the characteristics, all that kind of stuff, because I think they're very, very valuable for any young person who is wanting to become an investor, a business person, entrepreneur. Does it go without saying, this friend is now a former friend. Was there no legal action that you could take?
There's nothing we could do. There's nothing in writing. He's non-domiciled. He's not even based in the UK. We looked at every possibility, but there was nothing we could do.
You're not in communication with him no more?
None at all. No, he won't reply to my emails. He doesn't take my calls. He even told me that he was going to leave me a load of money in his will, but I'm guessing that's also not likely to happen these days. But yeah, it was a lesson. I mean, you know, lots of things spur you on in life. I got divorced very young, and it really drove me to be successful. This happened to me later in life, but again, drove me to be really successful, because, you know, you get that fuck you mentality, don't you, and that siege mentality, and you just think, right, I'm going to go and do it again. Mm. I've done it once, I can do it again. Mm. But it was unfortunate. It's taken me a lot of therapy to be able to say that that was unfortunate.
You mentioned therapy. I feel like it's more of a culture than ever before. I mean, you mentioned that 59, did you say? I'm 37, and I feel like I'm from an era where mental health and therapy and all that kind of stuff wasn't a thing. Like, my mum and dad were very much, especially my mum, it's quite hard. She's like, get on with it, like, type mentality. And I think that really served me. But as someone that's been through the, you know, around the block a few times and probably had mental sort of, you've been beaten up a couple of times during these acquisitions and different roles, how much is it important to kind of look at your mental health and get treatment every so often?
So years ago, mental health wasn't an issue. So when I was going through some of the stuff I was going through 20, 30 years ago, nobody talked about mental health. I think today, I wish I'd known 30 years ago what I know today. And I think everyone should have someone that they speak to. So a mentor, a coach, you know, it can be a psychiatrist if you want. Whatever you want it to be, it doesn't matter. It's whatever works for you. But I think everybody needs to vent. Everybody needs to express their feelings. Everybody needs somebody they can be completely open, honest and truthful with. It might be your wife. But it might not. It might be a business coach. It might be, as I say, it might be a lifestyle coach. But I think they play an increasingly important role. I really do. I think mental health is a real thing, and I think it's incredibly important for everybody that sets out on this journey to have somebody that they can share and talk, and yeah, very important.
So going back to the deal, then, you know, like, what are the key factors and characteristics that a CEO or a leader must have when you're trying to get over the line these huge, huge deals? I mean, you've gone from a very large number, and most people would be like, I'm just taking the money, I'm going to leave, because it's a huge amount of money. How do you have, like, the balls, the guts to go, no, this isn't enough, this isn't the person I want to sell to, this is the person I want to sell to, and have that one defining call that changes the course of the business forever?
I think, like I said at the beginning, you need to know where your exit is, and you need to believe in that exit, and you need to build everything towards that exit. And I passionately believed, not because I wanted to be on the board of Thomas Cook, but I passionately believed that Thomas Cook were the buyer for that business. And so they had the money, they had the gaps in their product portfolio. So I knew that it fitted them. So yeah, it risking the 72 to make the 86 was never for me even a consideration. I just knew that, passionately believe that Thomas Cook had to buy it, and I had to do everything I possibly could to convince them to buy it, and they did buy it, and it was a great acquisition for them, and I did get my seat on the board, and I did then later become CEO. So whilst I didn't get paid for selling the business, I did achieve the sort of the lifelong ambition.
Yeah.
30 years later, that I set out to achieve when I was 19.
Yeah.
But I do believe you've got, if you're going to be a strong leader and a good entrepreneur, you've got to believe in yourself. You've got to passionately believe in yourself. I sat on the board of Thomas Cook, and I've used this example before, and there'd be 20 people around the boardroom table because we own lots of different brands. We own lots of different holiday companies that at the time were very big household names. And each one of them had a managing director that all reported to me. And I remember this particular day where we were debating an acquisition, and if there were 20 people around the table, 19 people were saying no. And I was the only person that believed it was a yes. And it's very, very easy in that situation to think, you're all clever people, you're all here because of what you've achieved. You all believe it's a no, you must be right, I'll just cave and go with the no. It takes a great leader with big balls to say, I respect every one of you around this table, but you're all wrong. And it's a yes, and we're going with the yes. And that for me defines a good leader. And I've had to do that on more than one occasion. And I've been right to follow my gut. And all those people would then come to me individually afterwards and say, incredible.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
You became the CEO of Thomas Cook's, and there was something I listened to in one of your interviews where Thomas Cook had this catchy quote, the former owners, CEOs, got rid of it and tried to make it a bit more corporate. And then when you came back in, and I'll allow you to tell the story, you came back in and implemented back that quote. As the CEO of Thomas Cook, sweating the small stuff and the devil in the detail, how important was that for you?
Yeah, it's vitally important. So what you do is, the first thing you do is you surround yourself with a really good team of people. You know, if you're the managing director of a company, the clue's in the title. Your job's to manage the directors. So I'm never going to be the best finance director, I'm never going to be the best marketing director, I'm never going to be the best sales director. But if I can employ those people and employ the best in the business, they're going to make me look good. They're going to reflect on me. My board's going to be really, really strong. And what that then does is that then allows me, because I'm not specifically in sales or marketing or finance, that allows me the time to holistically look at the business and look at every part of the business and what's working and what's not working and tinker with the small bits. Because, you know, one of the things that we did at Gold Medal, going back to Gold Medal, we were turning over £300 million a year. And when we looked at the competitive set in the industry, they were charging more, a little bit more for insurance, they were charging a little bit more for ticketing, they were charging a little bit more for credit card fees. So when we tweaked our numbers to match all of them, we might have put 3% on our bottom line. Well, 3% on a 300 million turnover business is £9 million profit. Mm-hmm. But you don't have the time to do that if you get too bogged down in finance, marketing, sales. So what you do is you get the best in the business to free up your time so that then you can do that, and then you're the one that's making all the difference while they're getting on with the day job. Does that make sense? Mm. So that's what we did. So the phrase you're talking about was "Don't just book it, Thomas Cook it," which was for me one of the best marketing slogans ever. Even today, people of a certain age will say, you know, say, "Don't just book it." They'll say, "Thomas Cook it." You know, it sticks in people's minds. It was a little like Beans Means Heinz, you know, years ago, and it sticks in people's minds. And when I got to Thomas Cook's, they changed the slogan. It was like Thomas Cook's really nice holidays, or nice people to go on holiday with. And I'm like, what the fuck's that all about? Like, what is that doing? What is that saying? That's not saying anything to me. That is not.
Bland.
That's not what I want from Thomas Cook. So I went back and unashamedly reinstated the what I thought was a fantastic marketing slogan. Don't just book it, Thomas Cook it.
Talking about being ballsy and having being strong in certain scenarios, fast forward the clocks, you stepped away from Thomas Cook because your mindset was you wanted to buy Thomas Cook, and you tried to raise £500 million within a few 24 hours or a couple of days or whatever. Tell me about that. Why did you want to try and buy Thomas Cook?
So the same people who would say no when I knew it was a yes were all kind of old suits. Thomas Cook was a little bit, the board was a little bit like an old gentleman's club. And I think they saw me as a bit of a young maverick. You know, who's this guy 20 years younger than us telling us what we should do with our business? Who is he? How's he got here? Why is he the CEO? Why are we listening to him? And we were coming into a time when the internet was in danger of taking over the travel industry. You could see it coming a mile off. I could see it coming a mile off. They couldn't. So at that time, we had 1,500 shops. We owned an airline and we owned hotels, right? The shops were going to be a thing of the past as far as I was concerned. Yes, you want strategic high street locations, but you don't need three in the same high street in Glasgow, which is what we had. So to me, the shop network needed to go from 1,500 to 300. We owned an airline. We were rubbish at running an airline. Our on-time departure was shocking. Our service levels were shocking. We were just not good at running an airline. All these low-cost airlines like Ryanair and EasyJet were all starting up, all had thousands of seats that we could easily go and buy from them. We didn't need to own aircraft. And similarly, we didn't need to own hotels for the same reasons. So I went to the board with a plan and I said, look, we need to cull the shops from 1,500 down to 500 and then to 300. We need to sell the airline, we need to sell the hotels. And with the hundreds of millions of pounds that we're going to raise from that, we need to build the best internet site in the world. And this was before Expedia, right? Before anybody else was doing what I'm talking about, this is what we needed to do. And they all said, you're mad. You don't know what you're talking about. And I said, look, this industry is going to change beyond all recognition. And if you guys don't change with it, you're going to be dinosaurs and you're going to die with it. And they couldn't see it. They didn't share my vision. And I felt, you know, I've achieved my life ambition. I'm sat here as a CEO, but you're not listening to me. You don't share my vision. You don't see the danger that you're putting the business in. I don't want to be any part of this. But what I do want to do is I want to try and buy it off you cheaply. and I want to prove to you all that I was right, you were wrong, and I'm going to go and make a fortune. So I resigned from the position, and I went out into the city with a friend of mine who has a boutique business in Mayfair, helping to raise funds to buy distressed assets. And he set up 5 meetings for me to go and talk to 5 different people about raising £500 million. So the plan was get £100 million off each of them, and it's been a good day's work. I went to the first meeting and in Henley-on-Thames, and I sat with a guy, and I explained my vision to him in 45 minutes. And at the end of the 45 minutes, he said to me, "What are you doing for the rest of the day?" And I said, "I've got 4 more of these talks I've got to go and give, got to raise this £500 million. And he said, "Cancel the rest of the day, let's go for lunch, I'm going to write you a cheque for the full amount." And I literally raised £500 million in 45 minutes to go and buy Thomas Cook's. He saw the passion, he saw the energy, he saw the hunger, he saw the vision, he shared my vision, and he was happy to write me a cheque for £500 million in 45 minutes. And we went for lunch the rest of the day and got absolutely hammered. I went back to the board of Thomas Cook's. I met with the chairman. I submitted the offer. Unfortunately, they then asked me to do a presentation to the board as to what I would change. I told them all the things I'd told them previously. They still didn't share my vision. They turned down the offer. They refused the £500 million. And 18 months later, Thomas Cook's was bust.
What a story.
Sad.
Very sad.
Very sad story, because it was, for me, it was an iconic brand. It was, I feel still today, it was the best brand in the travel industry. I was so proud to be associated with it. I was so proud to lead that business. And I was devastated to see it die.
It's like when you see Woolworths and all these kind of brands, these are the ones that when you were growing up, like, they were the backbone of almost the economy in some views. Thomas Cook is definitely one of those big names that is always going to be in the history books. Sales, closing, raising money. I mean, 500 million within 45 minutes a presentation.
Passion.
Did you just shock yourself?
Passion, energy, belief, desire, knowledge. I don't know, I didn't really shock myself, because as I was talking to the guy and I felt the energy that I was giving was, you know, being reciprocated, as I'm talking to the guy, I'm thinking, I can get more money than this out of you. I can get more. I didn't expect the full 500 million, don't get me wrong. But I did feel as though when I was talking to him, he was buying into everything I was saying. And I did believe that I could get more than I was asking for. I didn't for 1 minute think he was going to write the check for the full amount, but Bless him, he did.
The former people, the board members, the owners of Thomas Cook, when they eventually went into liquidation, it disappeared off face of the earth. Was you ever in contact with them again? Did they ever circle back around and say, "Do you know what? We got it. We didn't take the 500 million.
So unfortunately, so the people that lost the money were the shareholders, and the shareholders were people like you and me. It was a public company. So, you know, grandmas and your next door neighbour could buy shares in Thomas Cook. So they were the real losers, because they lost all their investment money. The people that turned down the offer, the chairman, the people on the board, they just go and work for another company now, and they're somewhere else, and they're fucking up another business somewhere else now, because they messed up Thomas Cook's and now they're going to do it somewhere else. The really frustrating thing was that the chairman just didn't share my belief. For whatever reason, he didn't like me. He thought I was a maverick. He didn't like the energy. He didn't like what I was trying to do. He wanted to protect his old boys' network, and I was a massive threat to that. And I was in there to shake up the whole thing, and that's what I did. And he didn't like it, and therefore he had no hesitation in turning the offer down, even though it wasn't in the best interest of the shareholders.
How does a guy who used to be the CEO of Thomas Cook go from that then to owning a football club?
Football club came before that. Football club came after I sold my first business, Travel World, and I was living in Huddersfield. My business was based in Huddersfield, and I was a Leeds United fan, but I was asked to join the board of Huddersfield Town, and I was a massive, passionate sports fan, so I thought, you know, why not? And I went and joined the board at Huddersfield, and again, it was an old boys network. I was the youngest on the board. They brought me in there to help them with marketing and with sales, and to sort of attract more fans to the stadium, but they were playing in a very old stadium with a very old board of directors with very old ideas, And I went to three board meetings, and at the third board meeting, I made them an offer and bought the club. No intention of owning a football club. I had no real knowledge of running a football club, and I certainly had no knowledge of the amount of time it would take me away from my core business, which it did, because your passion takes over and your business becomes almost less important. But yeah, it was an exciting journey. It was great. As I say, I'm not a Huddersfield Town fan. I'm unashamedly a Leeds United fan, born and bred. Fortunate enough to grow up in the Don Revy era and see the great teams in the 70s. So buying Huddersfield was a business decision, and I'm fortunate enough to say that I'm very good friends with Simon Jordan, and Simon owned Crystal Palace at the time I owned Huddersfield. And Simon and I approached the football business in different ways, and I managed to leave unscathed. And Simon's story, I'm sure people well know, he lost heavily on Crystal Palace because, say, the passion takes over. For me, the fortunate thing was I wasn't passionate enough about Huddersfield Town, so I wasn't going to spend all my money on it. If I'd ever got on the board of Leeds, it might have been a different story.
So you've loads of successful businesses, loads of things that you're investing into, and you've lived in different parts around the world. What kind of drives you still today, Terry? Like, what is your mission, being 59 years young?
I think not to stop. You know, I feel much younger than I am. You very kindly said I look much younger than I am. I think I need to keep that momentum going. You know, I'm always looking at new opportunities. I'm always looking for new business ideas. I'm not in danger of slowing down yet. My son's 19 and he's at university, and he tells me in 3 years' time when he finishes, he's going to take over. And maybe at that stage, you know, we'll start to bring him into the business, and I might start to take a little bit of a back seat. But I've still got loads of energy, loads of passion, loads of drive, loads of desire, loads of things I still want to achieve. So I'm not done yet. I am done, I think, with the travel industry. People ask me a lot, you know, would you go back into the travel industry? And I think for me, the difficulty with that is that once you've been CEO of one of the world's biggest travel companies, it's hard to find something that motivates you enough in the travel industry. I'm not saying I would never do it, but it would have to be something very special.
Yeah. Do you know, you as a business person, like, does the net worth stimulate you? Does the accolades of buying, scaling, supporting a dying business, do you turn it around? Does that get you going? Like, what is the ultimate thing that really, really factors into the decisions that you make when you step forward to a company?
It's not about making the money. I think I've ticked those boxes. It's about seeing an opportunity and believing you can make a difference. And it's about bringing the right people in who share that vision and want to be successful. And I have created, if that's the right word, about 12 millionaires in my business career who have joined me in a business that I'm involved in and have subsequently made in excess of £1 million each and become millionaires in their own rights. One or two who've gone on to be extremely successful as a result of working and learning and sitting on a board alongside me. And I take great pride in that I've helped those people change their lives and become incredibly successful in their own right. So I'm still always looking for people I can do that with, people I can help, people I can, you know, the four guys from Norway who developed the Voicy app, their ambition, when I met them, I said, what does success look like? And they said, if we can make $1 million each, that would be hugely successful. They took $25 million each off the table when we sold Voicy 18 months later. I get a huge kick from doing that. I really do.
It's life-changing, isn't it?
For them, it's life-changing. And for me, you know, it just... I say to my kids, you know, lots of people can build and sell one business. And when you've done that, you want to go and do the second one because you want to prove that you weren't lucky.
It wasn't a fluke.
It wasn't a fluke, and you can do it twice. Some people can do it twice. I've done it six times, and I'm looking for the next six. So, you know, something I was born with or I picked up along the way has helped me to achieve that. It's not a great education. It's a great belief, I think, in your own ability. It's passionately believing in that you can do what you set out to achieve, and no ambition is too high, and even at 19 you want to run the biggest travel company in the world, well, go and do it, because you can if you really, really set your mind to it. And I know it sounds ridiculous, and lots of people listening will think, well, how am I ever going to do that? But trust me, I was a 19-year-old kid with no money and no qualifications.
You mentioned a word, lucky. What part does luck play in the business world?
I've got a saying that sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. You meet the right people, you're in the right place at the right time. I've just been introduced, I won't talk about it now because maybe I'll get to come back and talk about it again in the future, but I've just been introduced this week to a potentially fantastic opportunity, and it was pure luck. I was in the right place at the right time, and somebody said, oh, you should talk to Terry about that, and it's something that's evolving and developing, and may mean me having to jump on a plane to Dubai tomorrow morning, but yeah, so sometimes it's about being lucky, it's about having a lucky break, it's about, you know, lots of people tell you this, musicians, you know, there's lots of great guitarists, but Brian May was lucky because he met Freddie Mercury, you know, and he became Queen, and you know, they're my favourite band, by the way, so as you might have guessed. So, you know, but there'll be lots of other guitarists out there who think they're just as good as Brian May, but they weren't lucky enough to be in that right room at the right time and be introduced to Freddie Mercury, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I do think luck plays an important part.
I know money's not important to you right now, okay? And, you know, you're blessed to be in a position where you've made a lot of money and you've got a very, you know, you've got a lot of experience, wise head on your shoulders, and it appears that if you go into most businesses now, you would make a very positive impact on that business because of all the success and money you've made. But once upon a time, Terry, you didn't have any money. So when you was a young man, a young entrepreneur, how important was it for you, not necessarily to become a millionaire, but just to have money in your pocket? How important was that for
you? It was crucially important. I mean, it was important. I mean, I started building my business when I was 19, so I was working 24/7. I didn't have a lot of friends. I didn't go out a lot because I was really focused on building the business. And I had friends who were buying flashy cars at 19, or they were going off playing golf at 19, or they were doing whatever they were doing at 19. And I wasn't. I was working really hard because it was important to me to try and make money. What I didn't realize at the time, I think, was that, and I realize now, was that all those years of trying to make money at 19 to 30, really set me for life, you know, really helped me achieve the basis of why I'm successful today, because I was able to buy a house, I was able to buy other things that are then increasing value, and you're not just making money from building businesses, but you're making money from the equity that's growing and the things that you've been able to do because you've made money in building the businesses. So I think, you know, there's a lot of knock-on effects, a lot of positive effects from making money from a fairly early age if you really set about doing that. But you know, I used to have conversations with my dad when I was first building the business, and we'd say, you know, we've had a really good week this week, and we can have steak on Friday. And if we just get a few more sales over the line, we might be able to have a bottle of wine with it. You know, and it was literally like that in the very early days. I remember being determined that by the time I was 21, I wanted to have a Porsche. That was my, you know, next ambition, and I was fortunate enough to go and buy a Porsche when I was 22, so I just missed it by a few months. But you've got to set yourself targets and achievable targets, but then your achievable targets become greater and your ambitions become greater as you become more and more successful. And yeah, money's not as important today as it was 30 years ago, but it's still, you know, I've still got huge overheads. I've got lots of kids, lots of ex-wives, lots of expenses, lots of monthlies going out, so it's still relatively important.
Mm. This is going to be a couple of last questions I was going to ask you. So, like, when you have made large chunks of money, I'm always curious to find out what people spend it on. Now, there's the political answer. Oh, yeah, I put it on my wife, my kids, my other investments. But how do you enjoy your money, Terry? What do you buy?
I buy art. I'm not particularly, I've had the nice cars, I've done that. I'm not particularly showy, I don't think, but I do like to have a beautiful home and I like to have beautiful art. So yeah, next time I sell a business, I'll go and treat myself to a, you know, crazy piece of art. And then I'll look at that piece of art and think, that business bought me that. The apartment that I've just bought, Voicy bought me that. You know, so I've got quantifiable assets to look at and say, I worked really, really hard, but look what I got from it.
Yeah.
So I do like to reward myself. You know, it might start out years ago buying a Rolex Daytona when you sold a business because that was a thing to have. And then it might have been a Porsche, and then it might have been a house, and now it might be a piece of art. You know, there's always something that you aspire to that you really, really want. And I think it's important to reward yourself. It's important to tell the universe that you're glad you've made a lot of money because you're open to making lots more money. If you just miser it away or put it in the bank or, you know, like you say, the old cliche, you put it into your family or whatever else, you know. No, you've got to reward yourself. You've got to pat yourself on the back and you've got to have something to show for it.
I know you probably get asked this all the time, but I just wanted to see what your answer is. So a young entrepreneur, a young angel type investor, someone that is trying to make a mark in the world, someone that doesn't want to work 9 to 5 and someone that is a trailblazer, but they're kind of a little bit wet behind the ears. They might have all the passion, might have all the energy, but they're a little bit of a, not a laser beam, they're a bit, you know, full of energy, but they don't know whether to turn left or right or go straight. What's the advice that you give them?
I think believe in yourself, believe in your ambition, be really clear. Like, don't, you know, if you don't know to go left or right, that's a bit of a worry because if you've got that drive and that ambition and that intensity, you should know the route that you want to go down. But I think you've got to stick to your ambition. You've got to not let anybody sway you from that. You've not got to let the naysayers, you know, the people that told me at college that I wasn't qualified to work in the travel industry, you know, that could have derailed me completely, but I didn't allow that to happen. But I also think if you're young and you want to be successful, I do think you should probably get a mentor, somebody who's done it and achieved some success in their life, because I made a lot of mistakes along the way. I could have saved myself a lot of heartache, probably a broken marriage and probably loads of money if I'd listened and taken advice from somebody maybe a little bit older, a little bit wiser. But when you're young and you're impetuous, you think you know it all and nobody can tell you anything. But again, if I'd known then what I know now, I would certainly have done that. So I think, you know, it would be stick to your guns. Don't let anybody talk you out of it. Don't let anybody tell you you're wrong when you know you're right. Don't just try to please the crowd by, if they're all saying it's no and you know it's yes, don't agree with them. And try and find yourself somebody good that you can talk to, that you can share with, that can act as a mentor and help you get to where you need to be.
I came up with a quote when I first started my first sales company when I was about 24 years of age. And the quote goes like this: be happy, never content. Now, I've got my own interpretation of that. What does be happy, never content mean to Terry Fisher?
I think for me, if you're not careful, you can be successful but not successful enough. So you hit this level where you get complacent. You've got the car, your wife's got money to spend wherever she wants to spend it, you've got the nice house, the kids are in private school, and you get complacent, you get content, right? And you hit this sort of plateau, and a lot of businesses don't grow, don't expand, or people don't become more successful because they hit that level and they're content. And I think for me to be truly happy, I need more than that. I need to be more than content. I need to be successful. I need people to recognize that success, and I need to keep growing and keep moving forward. And contentment for me would have seen me probably still married, probably still living in Leeds, probably never have gone to LA, probably never got tattoos, probably never met the girl that I met, probably never now living in London and being an art collector, because I was content because I had a Porsche and a nice house in suburbia in Leeds and my kids were in private school. And that life just wasn't for me. And I make no apologies for that. I make no excuses for that. I just knew that wasn't enough. It wasn't big enough. It wasn't going to satisfy me. So I think content is a pretty dangerous place for me to be.
Love that answer. Thank you very much for your time, mate. Really, really enjoyed it. I hope to stay connected. And now I know you're a big art collector. Why don't you come over to our next exhibition on the 29th of November?
That's my birthday. That's the day I'm in Hong Kong selling my piece in the Christie's sale.
Okay.
But maybe the one after that.
For sure.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much. Be happy, never content, and make sure you are subscribing. Cheers.
Thank you.